The Writer's Voice. To celebrate our 30 years of service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work. The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.
Today, we're very happy to welcome Catherine Kalos from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Catherine, thank you for being here with us today.
Well, thank you for considering me a celebrity. I don't think anyone has ever done that before.
Well, we hear your name often enough because we do, of course, on the Virginia Voice read byline. So we certainly think that you're a celebrity. You've been at the paper for a good long time now, haven't you?
Yeah, I call it forever and a day. I came there in 1974. I was just a baby, and I've been there ever since. I was actually the news leader before the papers merged, and I came there to cover women's issues back when women's clubs were active and the Equal Rights Amendment was a big issue and abortion was something that had rallies here and there. And so I kind of followed all that stuff for many years. And then when the papers merged, they created this new position that they called travel writer. And so actually, one of the other things I had done was during the summer, we had had a travel page at the News Leader that just focused on Virginia, mm-hmm. and I had been coordinating that for several years. So I had gotten an idea of what travel resources were out there, and when they created this position, I thought, well, that would be pretty nice. And so my kids were a little bit young. They were 3 and 7 at the time, and I thought, well, what was it? No, 3 and 6. But anyway, I thought that was a little bit younger than I wanted, so but I thought, whoever gets this is not going to give it up. If I ever want to do it, I'd better apply for it. And so I did, and I got it, and I was totally right about that because I never gave it up.
And you traveled far and wide with that.
I did.
Beyond the boundaries of Virginia.
Yeah, they weren't sure what they were going to do with it when they first started it. But then they decided, yeah, we really want to go out and see the world. So I got to go to Australia and New Zealand. That was my first big trip, and I did South Africa, I did England a couple of times, I did France and Spain and Greece. I kind of had this Mediterranean thing going for a while. I did Italy, Israel, Morocco, Tunisia. I did, you know, it was
incredible.
It was incredible. It was wonderful. You know, I had, the first time I ever went abroad for the paper, I said, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip. And it was to Korea in 1979 when there was a friendship force group going over there, and the government had just had a coup and the country was under martial law. And people were saying, I don't think I want to do that. And they said, well, we better send a reporter just in case. And so I happened to be next in line. I had covered the friendship force group that came here, and they said, well, if we ever send anybody on a trip, you'll be the one, of course, thinking they never would. But then this thing came up, and they did, so I got to go to Korea, and I thought, wow, this is incredible.
Do you still write travel stories?
Not very often. I did write one about Washington, D.C. for this just a few weeks ago. But 2 years ago, they decided, you know, the way the newspaper business is going, we really need you to be closer to home. And so last year I was part of the Chesterfield team and South of the River team, but I called it kind of whatever. I was just writing on whatever needed to be covered. But a few months ago, they have assigned me to Henrico County to cover schools and government, and so I'm still discovering what that means. But
well, many of our listeners live both in Chesterfield and in Henrico, so we'll be certainly reading your stories. You've brought some things to share with our listeners today. Tell me about what you're going to read first.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'm going to read is a thing I wrote just a few weeks ago about Tommy Edwards. He is in Henrico, or he was born in Henrico, and he died in Henrico, and he was a number one singer back in the 50s, and then he kind of just faded away and people forgot about him. Except after I wrote this story, I discovered there were a lot of people who still remembered him.
Okay, well, let's hear the story.
Okay. Tommy Edwards may be the best-known local singer most people have never heard of. If you were around in the 1950s, though, you were probably singing his song. The Henrico County-born balladeer's version of It's All in the Game was the number one hit in the country for 6 weeks in 1958. His earlier recording of the song had reached number 18 in 1951. He made television appearances on the Dick Clark Saturday Night Beach Nut Show, the Ed Sullivan Show, and Your Hit Parade, and then he faded away. By the time Donald W. Gunter, who's now 62, moved from Roanoke to Richmond in 1977, he said, "I was surprised that it wasn't better known among Virginians that we had a singer with a million record song. Even Richmonders weren't aware that Tommy was from this area. Here was a guy who was internationally known, but a lot of people didn't know he was from Henrico County." Gunter set out to change that. He's succeeded in at least two respects since he joined the staff of the Library of Virginia in 1987. As assistant editor of the Dictionary of Virginia Biography, he wrote about Tommy Edwards for the not-yet-published fourth volume of the library's biography series after finding Edwards' name on the master list. Working with the library's historical marker program, Gunter also got a Tommy Edwards highway marker installed recently in front of Pemberton Elementary School, a short distance from where Edwards is buried in Quiaquasson Baptist Church's cemetery in Henrico. In the course of his research, Gunter has accumulated 7 boxes of material on the singer, ranging from copies of Billboard and Variety magazines to more than 100 recordings of Edwards' songs. "In the beginning, I worked on the biography," Gunter said. "It became a personal pursuit." Thomas Jefferson Edwards was born in Henrico on October 15, 1922, and died there at age 47 on October 23, 1969. He went to New York in 1946 as a songwriter. His first success, "That Chick's Too Young to Fry," was recorded by Louis Jordan. Others who recorded his songs include Tony Bennett, Red Foley, and Tony Fontaine. But Edwards didn't write the song that catapulted him to number one status. "It's All in the Game" began as Melody in A Minor, written in 1911 by Charles G. Dawes, a businessman and amateur composer who served as U.S. Vice President under Calvin Coolidge from 1925 to 1929. After lyrics were added by Carl Sigman in 1951, Edwards was one of several singers who recorded it. Edwards charted several songs in the ensuing 2 years, but by the mid-1950s, his career was flagging. In 1958, he had only one more recording session left on his contract with MGM, and the label asked him to update It's All in the Game with a rock and roll backbeat. It sold 3 million copies. The next 2 years were his most successful, with 13 more songs on the charts. But by 1961 to 62, he had stopped recording. In 1967, he came back home to Henrico and was living with his sister, Gunner said. "He was pretty broke by this time," Gunner said. "He was drinking too much. I think there was a depression." When Edwards died in 1969, he was buried without a headstone. The gravesite is another thing Gunter has worked on. He located surviving members of Edwards' family in North Carolina, including an 87-year-old sister, at about the time they learned they were due more than $250,000 in royalties from Edwards' music. Some of that money paid for a granite stone at the gravesite last summer. Gunter is still trying to spread the word, but he's feeling better about Edwards' legacy. "I wanted some permanent commemoration of his career in music," Gunter said. "He was one of Virginia's most successful recording artists."
That is fascinating.
Isn't it? That's just one of those stories that you go into and you find more and more levels the more you write about it. And people are still several weeks later. Every now and then I'll get an email from somebody who's found it on the Internet. And Carl Sigmund's son was one of them who contacted me and sent me. I got it just this week. He sent me a CD of Carl Sigmund's songs. It's like 3 CDs recordings, all the people who've recorded Carl Sigmund songs, and the son has put them all together in this CD.
Do many interesting things like that happen? Do people react to your stories very often?
Sometimes. Sometimes it's, when you're running government things, it often it's provoking an argument among people who have differing opinions on what the government ought to do. Things like this, the ones I brought today are things that are more fun.
Well,
and that people might care about more, you know, weeks after it's happened. You know, just interesting little tidbits that we've discovered along the way.
I can't wait to hear the next story.
Oh, well, this next one is about a Richmond lawyer who uncovered a fraud in New York State just totally by accident. So I'll read you that. Joseph Romito is a Richmond lawyer by day and, as it turns out, a history sleuth by night. His interest in a letter by John C. Calhoun on eBay resulted in the arrest of a New York State employee accused of stealing hundreds of documents from the New York State Library. Calhoun was vice president from 1825 to 1832 under Andrew Jackson, and he served as Secretary of War in 1817. Romito, who concentrates on estate planning at the Framey Law Firm, flew from Richmond to New York yesterday, and we're talking yesterday in January 2008, for a news conference announcing the arrest of Daniel D. Lorello, 54, of Rensselaer, New York. Lorello worked as an archivist at the State Library in Albany, giving him access to more than 20 million books, documents, maps, and other resources relating to the history and culture of the state, authorities said. Yesterday, Lorello pleaded not guilty to charges of grand larceny, criminal possession of stolen property, and scheme to defraud, and was released on his recognizance, according to the Associated Press. He faces up to 25 years in prison if convicted. Romito said he's interested in the history of the American South, particularly in the period before the Civil War. A friend in North Carolina had given him a ceramic bust that he thought might be Calhoun, so Romito went on eBay to try to identify it. Instead, a four-page letter written by Calhoun to a New York colonel in 1823 caught his eye. Romito read the seller's transcription and, as he explained at the news conference, "I thought it had quite a bit of political content. I was curious to know if it was in the edited edition of the collected papers of John C. Calhoun. I pulled the document off my shelf, largely to see who Colonel Hayne was. And there was the letter, the very same letter, the underlining, the spellings, everything. The book listed the letter's sources in the New York State Library. Why would the library relinquish this?" Romito said he asked himself. "Libraries are repositories where things go and stay forever." I resolved then to make a telephone call to the State Library the next day. In a phone interview last night after he'd returned to Richmond, Romito said he was cautious when he first contacted the library. "I had to be wary that I wasn't talking to the thief." His call started an investigation. The State Attorney General's office became one of the bidders for the Calhoun letter after library staff members determined that it was indeed missing from the collection. Romito also put in an early bid just to make sure it didn't fall into the wrong hands before he found out that the Attorney General was on the trail. After Lorello's arrest, authorities said, he confessed to stealing between 300 and 400 items in 2007, the year he said he took the Calhoun letter. He said he began stealing from the library in 2002. The most expensive item Lorello sold was an 1835 Davy Crockett Almanac that went for $3,200 on eBay in December. He said he sold the items to pay his bills. New York Attorney General Anthony Cuomo and Education Commissioner Richard Mills presented Romito with a certificate of appreciation with faux parchment and a faux gold frame. "One day, 100 years from now, this will be worthless anyway," Cuomo said, "but it may be on eBay."
That's great. That's wonderful. Do you know now, was the New York State Library able to recover the things that this guy had stolen and sold?
You know, I don't. We didn't follow up on that. I suppose maybe I could find out and let you know.
We'll look for that in the newspaper.
Okay. All right.
Now, I want to be conscious of time here, so I want to keep you reading because these are great.
All right, this is a story I wrote about a funeral for a student at Thomasdale High School, and it was a time when there had been a string of deaths at Thomasdale, and the community was really upset about it. So here's how it starts. It was in January of 2008. Thomasdale High School has gotten all too accustomed to tragedy in the past 9 months. 4 students at this Chester school have died since May. 7 have died in the past 3 years. Yesterday was the day to say goodbye to Andrew Clark, 17, who loved sunflower seeds and beef jerky, who bonded with his big brother over championship soccer, who might torment his little sister even as he made sure no one else did. He was killed Monday when his car veered off the road and hit the stone entrance to Meadowville Technology Park. For the Thomasdale community, it was a bad beginning to another bad week. It's a real bizarre situation, just everything that Thomasdale has had to endure in the last 3 years, said Jim Belcher, who teaches at the school. You feel like the odds at some point would stop singling your school out. The cumulative effect of the losses may have contributed to the overwhelming turnout for Clark's funeral. About 800 people showed up at J.T. Morris Funeral Home for visitation with the family Wednesday evening, some of them waiting for hours to pay respects. About 500 came to the funeral yesterday in Colonial Heights at the Highland United Methodist Church, which holds only 300 people. The overflow filled the foyer and spilled into the street. Many of the mourners joined the procession to Sunset Memorial Park in Chester, where dusk was falling by the time everyone gathered around the gravesite next to a bare crepe myrtle tree. It's a great loss, said Rashida Brown, a fellow student who said she felt Clark's death even more because of the others that preceded it. I was really, really close with Malcolm Piggott, who passed before, she said. It's not good for me. So many people, agreed Dylan Martin, a classmate standing nearby. Students cope by hanging out with each other, trying to talk with each other, he said. Hallways have been quiet this week as students absorb the news, said Megan Hicks and Candace Wood, shivering in their short-sleeved dresses after the sun went down and a few raindrops started to fall. Thomasdale is immune to it. You expect it, one said. We all just have to get in there and be true knights, the other added. It's really hard. At the funeral, family and friends spoke about the boy they loved. Bobby Clark, his father, talked about his son's soft heart for animals and love of practical jokes. Eric Clark, his brother, said he'd put the soccer game FIFA 07 in the casket, so if you ever get bored, you'll have something to play. Daniel Morrison, president of the senior class, praised Andrew Clark's fearlessness and his willingness to live life without regret, even in the most dismal of time. Patrick Ennis remembered the way Clark would get laughs by imitating people, including his soccer coach and his minister. At the cemetery, soft sobs gave an undertone to the short cemetery. Strong boys hugged each other and wept. Many of them took a moment to also remember Piggott, whose grave was just a short walk away. Piggott drowned last summer in a pond in Chester. Brown ran her fingers across the face of his heart-shaped tombstone before she turned away. Each time we suffer a loss, it impacts the entire school, said Stephen Nigro, a teacher. I have seen students who did not personally know Andrew crying because the feeling of losing a classmate and having it happen so often contradicts the belief that teenagers are indestructible.
Catherine, that was a very sensitive and beautiful piece.
It was very sad. You know, I have a son who's not too much older than these boys were at the time, and it just really hit home for me. It's like you hope and pray that everything will be all right, but you just never know. And boys do things sometimes that are risky, and you just can't prevent everything, but you hope you can take care of your own, or that they will take care of themselves.
Now, is that your 3-year-old who's grown up or your 6-year-old?
That was my 6-year-old who's grown up.
That's right. We didn't talk about the fact that throughout the years you've been building this very wonderful career, you also were raising a family.
That's right. Yeah. I have. My son now has graduated from college, and he's still looking for a real job. And my daughter is in college in California right now. So, yeah, they got to do some wonderful things with me along the ways, but they've also had wonderful lives of their own, which is what you hope.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you have something else to read for us?
Well, I could read you a little bit of a travel piece if you'd like.
Love that.
Okay. Well, this one is one of my early pieces. It's South Africa. It was in 1994, and it was a safari. So the safari experience hasn't changed that much. But as you can tell from this, it was my first safari, and I was reacting to everything. So here's how it begins. Night number one. It is midnight in the African bush, and I am listening. In the distance, a hyena is calling, but that's not the sound that's gotten my attention. I hear something scratching at the corner of my two-cot tent. Could it be the rodent we were warned about, the one that likes to eat toothpaste? I roll over, brushing my shoulder against the roof, and shine a pen light toward the noise. Nothing there. The light must have scared it away. I drift back to sleep. Night number two. It is 3 a.m. in the African bush, and I am listening. I've moved away from the small tents in the foot safari camp to the luxury tents in the main honey guide tented safari camp. Above my bed hangs a mosquito net, and a mosquito coil burns on top of the shelves that hold my clothes. A solar-powered lamp sits on the bedside table. There's a bathroom enclosure on the other side of my zipper tent flap. And that's the problem. My cosmetics case is out there, and as I listen to the baboons howling, I suddenly wonder whether they like to eat toothpaste, too. Have they reached inside the enclosure and carried my things into the tree? Are they ripping open my malaria pills? It gets quiet, and I think about opening the flap to check. But wait, I hear steps. Something is beside my tent. Something big. It's pulling leaves from the trees and dropping debris on my roof. I hear it chewing. Now I have a vision of an elephant and wonder if he's feeling around in the bathroom enclosure with his trunk, hunting for my cosmetics case. He probably needs some toothpaste, too. Finally, it's quiet. Really quiet. I'm tired of worrying about the cosmetics case. I unzip the tent flap, shine my pen light into the bathroom, see the cosmetics case, grab it, zip the tent, and go back to bed. Now I can sleep. Night number three. It is 11 p.m. in the African bush, and I am listening. The wind that blew up a marvelous thunderstorm during our evening safari now is pounding against the tent. I lie in the dark and wonder which of the noises means the tent is going to blow over. Finally, I turn on the light and watch. Despite the flapping and pinging and creaking, nothing important seems to be moving. Reassured, I turn off the light and go to sleep. Morning. It's 5:30 a.m. and I am listening. Birds are praising the sunrise with the most joyful noise I've ever heard. A drum sounds to wake us up for the morning safari, but it's not necessary. Who could sleep through such glee? We dress quickly and gather around the safari vehicles to compare nighttime noises. I realize my leaf eaters were giraffes, not elephants. Baboons, I'm told, don't bother things in the bathrooms. And there are some things you don't hear. Footprints indicate that lions came through the camp during the night. This is the real bush, and never does it seem more real than when staying in a tent. You're out there in the middle of it. There's nothing between you and the bush, said George DeVos of Delmas, South Africa, who had brought his 14-year-old son Hendrik on a first safari. This is what it's all about. You could stay in a hotel anywhere. Tented safaris have been associated with East Africa, while South Africa has traditionally placed more emphasis on luxury lodges. Kruger National Park has tents, but reservations there fill up a year in advance. Honey Guide Tented Safari Camp was one of the first private tented camps in South Africa. Its main camp overlooks a creek bed in Manuleti Game Reserve, which was set up under apartheid in the 1960s as a black-only version of Kruger. Only a fence separates the two parks, and it's supposed to come down soon, and I'm sure by now it has. In the 1970s, Manuleti became a multiracial park. When the northern area of the park was privatized, Honey Guide's first owners came in. They named the camp after a honey guide bird, which they followed to a cache of honey in a spot that seemed ideal for a safari camp. Last year, Honey Guide became part of the Lodges of Manuleti, which is also working with a dislocated tribal group to open a safari camp on former tribal lands within Kruger. Despite that larger connection, Honey Guide retains a small, personal feeling. Rangers know each of the guests by name. Only 16 people can be accommodated at the main camp, where much of the game viewing is in open vehicles. Only one other safari camp shares the 89-square-mile reserve, which means the groups often feel as if they have the wilderness all to themselves. Rangers keep in contact by radio to share sightings. The only time we felt like we were in a crowd was the night we saw two lions. Ranger Howard Spencer Wilson had spotted their spoor on an early morning drive and went out at midday to track them. That evening, four vehicles surrounded the lions as they finished their nap. Not far away, an elephant crashed through the bush. When we drove over for a look, the elephant flapped his ears and moved toward us. He was not pleased. Ranger Clinton Phillips whistled loud and yelled. He stood up, flailed his arms, and drove toward a thicket. The elephant followed us. It was beginning to seem like the nightmare that Brenda Douglas of Johannesburg had dreamed the night before. "Let me see what he'll do if I back up," Phillips said. He yelled, banged the side of the truck, and backed up. The elephant decided to move on. "It's an issue of dominance," Phillips said calmly, then called on the radio, "Howie, don't come looking for this elephant." Back at the lions, we watched as they stretched and moved out. The one with a dark mane who looked like Scar in the lion face and had a reputation for meanness walked so close to our vehicle that we wondered if he was going to scratch its back against the fender. "Were you scared, Howie?" another ranger asked him later. "Petrified," he said. "There's a rifle on the dashboard, but it's not much use if a lion springs at you. As long as no one stands up, however, the lions seem to regard the vehicles as a unit that's too big to bother with." Over sundown drinks at a nearby watering hole, we listened to the lions roar. "I think they're coming for a drink," Phillips said. "We'd better get in the truck." He didn't have to say it twice. Our other sightings were more tranquil. White rhinos grazed at dusk and dawn. Buffalo gathered at a watering hole where we stopped for sundowners. Elephants took their daily mud bath at the main camp's watering hole. Where a blind allowed guests to get exhilaratingly close. A blind is just a little shelter where you can see them and they can't see you. On foot safaris, we climbed on top of a 1,000-year-old termite mound, tracked a lion along the Kruger fence line until we saw tufts of hair where he'd slipped through to the other side, checked rhino droppings for warmth to gauge how close the animal was, and of course it was the ranger doing that and not us, walked through wastelands created by elephants foraging for food at the end of the dry season, and mimicked the call of a pearl-spotted owl to ruffle its feathers. The camp doesn't promise sightings of the Big Five, even though lions, rhinos, elephants, buffalo, and leopards live within Manuleti. Most guests see 3 to 5 of the trophy species in a 2 to 3 day stay. The only one we missed was a leopard. We saw a fresh kill, but the leopard never showed itself. Safari time moves at a different pace. Days begin with a game drive at sunrise, followed by breakfast around 9:30, and then the long, lazy midday is when people may take a nap or a shower or swim in the pool or a game walk. Lunch is around 3, followed by a game drive around 4. Dinner is around 9 o'clock. The experience can be addicting. On my last day, breakfast was served against a backdrop of elephants at the watering hole. Afterward, a threesome headed out on foot to see where they'd gone. I had a plane to catch, but I had to remind myself it was important. What I really wanted to do was find those elephants. Once you've heard the African bush, it's hard to let it go.
Catherine, that was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed writing that one and being there and doing that. So.
And we enjoyed listening to it. And that's as close as I imagine I'll ever get to the African bush, but I felt like I was there.
Oh, great.
I want to thank you for taking time today to join us. We've really enjoyed having you here.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here.
We've been talking with Times-Dispatch staff writer Catherine Kalos. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
Been listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.